I wish I could see her. I want to see her. I don't see her. I walk back to my unit, and I go to my room, and I lie down on my bed. Miles walks in, and he sits down on his bed, and he reaches for his clarinet case, and he starts unpacking it, and he asks if I mind if he plays, and I say, no, play whatever you want, for as long as you want. And I reach for a book, one of the books my brother gave me, and I don't bother looking to see what I'm reaching for, because I don't care. I just want to read, and I want to occupy my mind with something. The rage and need are back. They have returned, are alive as they almost always are, living and lingering and eating me away. I need something to occupy my mind. I don't care what it is. Occupy. I pull the Chinese book, the Tao Te Ching, by far the smallest of the three that I have, and the only one that I haven't read before. It is a small, thin paperback. The title is written across the front in simple white type against a black background. I flip the book over, and I look at the back, and there are quotes on the back from three sources that I have never heard of before, but that look like bullshit New Age hippie periodicals. There is a publication classification in an upper corner. It reads, Religion. I am immediately skeptical. Not only because of the source quotes and the religion classification, but because I've always grouped books such as this in a category with crap like astrology, aromatherapy, crystallology, pyramid powers, psychic healing, and feng shui, which at various times in my life have all been suggested as cures for my problems. That anyone would actually believe that these things could solve their problems, really solve them, instead of just making them forget about them for a while, is asinine to me. My brother gave me this book, though, so I'll read it. Had anyone aside from my brother given it to me, it would be sitting in the bottom of a garbage can. As I open it, Miles starts playing his clarinet. He plays softly and slowly. The notes are on the low side, and he draws them out to the point that I wonder how he's breathing. The notes are on the long side, and he makes them sound like they are easy to make, though I know they are not. Low and slow and soft and long and easy. I don't know what it is, but I like it. I skip the introduction. If the book goes in the trash, I want it to go because of my thoughts on it, not because of some asshole's thoughts who wrote the introduction. The text begins. It consists of a series of short poems numbered 1 through 81. The first one says that the Tao is that which has no name, and is beyond any sort of name. It says that names are not necessary for that which is real, and for that which is eternal. It says that if we are free from desire, we can realize mystery, that if we are caught in desire, we only realize manifestations. It says mystery and manifestations arise from the same source, which is darkness. It says darkness within darkness is the key to all understanding. It is not enough to make me throw it away, but I am also not convinced. I keep going. I keep going as I listen to low and slow and soft and long and easy. I keep going as I settle in beneath the warmth of my bed. And I keep going as I wait for the phone to ring. When the phone rings, I know I will get to hear the sound of Lily's voice. I want to hear the sound of Lily's voice. Number 2. If there is beauty, there is ugliness. If there is good, there is bad. Being and non-being, and difficult and easy, and high and low, and long and short, and before and after need, depend, create, and define each other. Those who live with the Tao act without doing, and teach without saying. They let things come, and they let things go. And they live without possession, and they live without expectation. They do not need, depend, create, or define. They do not see beauty or ugliness or good or bad. There just is. Just be. Number 3. Overesteem men, and people become powerless. Overvalue possessions, and people begin to steal. Empty your mind, and fill your core. Weaken your ambition, and toughen your resolve. Lose everything you know and everything you desire, and ignore those who say they know. Practice not wanting, desiring, judging, doing, fighting, knowing. Practice just being. Everything will fall into place. 4. The Tao is used, but never used up. An eternal void, it is filled with infinite possibilities. It is not there, but always there. It is older and more powerful than any god. It is not there, but always there. It is older and more powerful than any god. I stop reading, and I read them again, 1 through 4, again and again. The words and the words together and the meaning and the context are simple and basic, so basic and true, and that is all that matters, true. They speak to me, make sense to me, reverberate within me, calm, ease, sedate, relax, still, pacify me. They ring true, and that is all that matters, the truth. Although I am no expert on this, or anything related to this, or anything at all except being a fuck-up, I seem to understand what this book, this weird, beautiful, enlightened little book is saying to me. Live, and let live. Do not judge. Take life as it comes and deal with it. Everything will be okay. I close the book, and I let the sounds of the clarinet carry me, carry me, carry me. They are low and slow and soft and long and easy, as are the thoughts in my head. They carry me, carry me, carry me. Live, and let live. Do not judge. Take it as it comes. Deal with it. Everything will be okay. Screaming, long and loud and hideous, like a child being burned alive. I sit up in my bed. It is silent and dark. I don't know if it's real or a dream. Then it comes again, like a child being burned alive. I get out of my bed, and I walk out of my room, and I head toward the scream. It's coming from the main rooms of the unit, and with each step that I take, it becomes louder and more intense. It's like a fucking child being burned alive. I'm scared. The hair on the back of my neck is standing, and the hair on my arms is standing. And my heart is thudding, and my ears are ringing, and it's louder and more intense with each step. I want it to stop. I'm scared. Poor child. I'm scared. Poor child. I walk into the upper level. There are a couple of other men there, and they are staring down at the lower level with stunned faces. I follow their eyes and the sounds of the screams which are echoing through the room. And I see Roy standing on top of a couch, holding a thick, brutal wooden stick, short like a battering ram with a bloody, fragmented tip. He is waving the stick around, swinging at invisible enemies, and screaming at the top of his lungs. His clothes, which are old and torn, are covered in dirt and blood, as are his arms and his face and his hair, and his eyes are wide and empty, the whites a deep furnace red, the pupils an endless black. More men arrive, drawn in by the horrible shrieking screams, and they stand around the upper level watching Roy, unsure of what to do or how to react, unsure if there's a way to stop him. He has increased the pace of his madness, and he is jumping up and down on the couch, banging the stick against its back with one hand and clawing at his face with the other. Spit is flying from his mouth, and particles of blood are staining the carpet and the walls, and it appears as if he's pissed his pants, or is in the process of pissing his pants. He does not appear to notice that there is anybody else in the room. Lincoln arrives with a large man wearing a gray outfit and carrying a handheld radio, who I assume is some sort of security. They stand at the top of the stairs for a moment, watching Roy and talking quietly. When they stop talking, they begin descending the stairs, and Roy stops screaming, and he glares at them, and he raises his stick and he waves it at them. "Why are you trying to kill me?" Lincoln speaks quietly and calmly. "Roy, why are you trying to kill me?" "We're not trying to kill you, Roy." They reach the bottom of the stairs and they stop. "Who is Roy?" Lincoln steps forward. The man stays. Are you on something, Roy? Roy jumps up and down on the couch. He shakes his stick. I am not Roy! Lincoln steps forward. Who are you? My name is Jack, and I'll kill you. I'll kill you, you motherfucker! Lincoln turns and nods to the man, and the man starts talking into his radio. Lincoln turns back to Roy. Hi, Jack. I'll bash your head in, you two-faced bastard! Why would you do that, Jack? 'Cause I'm a killer! A cold-blooded mercenary killer! Two more men in gray arrive. The original man clears his throat. Lincoln turns around, motions them forward with his head, and steps toward Roy. The men reach into their pockets, and they draw out latex gloves, and they put them on. Why don't you give me the stick, Jack? Roy shakes the stick. This ain't no stick. It's a cudgel. A man hammer. The men move forward. Why don't you put down the cudgel, Jack? Pry it from my cold, dead fingers, fuckface! The men surround the couch. Lincoln stands in front of Roy. He is scowling and growling and moving in a circle to defend himself. I'll bash your heads in, you cocksuckers! Roy, I'll kill you to death till you're dead and die, you sons of whores! Roy, the men are looking at Lincoln, Lincoln at Roy. Roy spins, waving his stick and yelling, I'm Jack the Manhammer! I'll smash all of you to fucking bits! Lincoln nods at the original man, who nods to the other two men. When Roy turns his back, one of them tackles him from behind, sending his stick into the air and his body to the ground. The other two immediately jump on top of him, and they grab his arms, and as they try to subdue him, he claws at them, and he tries to bite them. When he knows he's done and beaten, he starts screaming, 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 like a child being burned alive. Most of the unit's men have gathered on the upper level, and they are watching as the men pick Roy up. One of them has his legs, one has his lower arms and lower torso, the third has his upper arms and upper torso. They carry him up the stairs and out of the unit, and his screams continue as they move through the halls. Though they are certainly taking him to an unpleasant place, I doubt it will be any worse than the place he was just in. It couldn't be. His screaming? No fucking way. Lincoln, who has been silently watching, turns to us. Show's over, boys. Go back to bed. No one moves. Go back to bed. No one moves. Ted speaks. You ain't got nothing else for us? A couple of laughs. Lincoln stares at Ted. It's not funny, Ted. Ted speaks. I thought it was. Lincoln ignores him. Go back to bed, everybody. We'll talk about this tomorrow. He stands and he stares until some of the men start trickling out. When they do, he walks up the stairs and he leaves. I am wide awake, and I am not going back to bed. Even if I went back to bed, there is no way I could sleep. The screams are echoing in my mind. The image of the blood and spit will not leave me. The words, I am not Roy, are alive inside. The emptiness and insanity in his eyes haunt me. I am not going back to bed. The screams were like a child being burned alive. I walk over to the coffee machine, and I start making the day's first supply. I fill the filter with cheap industrial grounds. I fill the tank with tap water. I push the on button. I stand and I wait as the water trickles through translucent brown and gurgles, gurgles, gurgles. When the water stops, I pour a cup of the coffee and I take a sip, and it's hot, and it's bitter, and it's good. No sugar and no cream. It's hot and bitter and good. I am not going back to bed. I am going to need the coffee. I am going to need it. I walk over to a table a few feet away. Some men have gathered at the table, and they are talking about what we just witnessed. I tell them the coffee is ready, and a couple of them stand to get a cup, and I sit down and I listen to them. The focus of the conversation is on what known drugs could do to a person, what was done to Roy, or more likely, what he did to himself. Crack could have done it. Meth could have done it. PCP or a large dose of acid could have done it, but nothing else readily available has the necessary power. Ted thinks that it was crack. He has experienced crack-induced psychosis several times. The last when he marched down the main street of a small town in Mississippi, wearing a Santa suit and throwing bags filled with shit at passing cars and pedestrians. A man I don't know thinks it was meth, and he believes that Roy probably hadn't slept in several days and was suffering from a severe case of sleep deprivation. Everyone else thinks it was PCP or acid. Either or both have the strength to take your mind, make you see and hear things that aren't there, and drive you insane. Either or both can do this to a person in the short term or the long term. Either or both can do this to a first-time user. The bald man says that Roy was a drinker, and that he hated drugs, and he hated everyone who used them, and that he would never have done them. He thinks he just went insane. No rhyme, no reason, just a malfunctioning mind that finally lost all. I don't have a theory. I sit and listen, and I drink my coffee, and I wait for the screaming to go away. The men drift back to bed, one by one, tired and tired of talking. They drift until I'm the last and only one awake, me and the industrial coffee, and the pale, quiet walls and the slow, lonely moments and the living, shifting dark of the deepest night. I sit at the table and I smoke cigarettes and I sip my coffee. I listen to the ticking of an unseen clock, and I think about how a malfunctioning mind might finally lose all, and I remember. Sit, stare, smoke, sip, listen, tick, remember. A malfunctioning mind can lose all. It has lost all. Remember. I remember her. I remember her tall and thin and long and blonde, like the thickest silk, her eyes blue, eyes, arctic eyes. I remember her. I remember leaving her on the afternoon I dropped off the bag of dope for Lucinda. I remember seeing her the next day. I remember not speaking to her, but wanting to speak to her, and not being able to speak to her. I remember staring at her, recklessly and obviously, eyes locked and loaded, and unmoving, my eyes straight into her. I remember not knowing if she noticed. I had fallen deep and hard. I had fallen. I didn't know if she noticed. I kept staring at her for the next year, in the street, through hallways, on sidewalks, at a table, outside a coffee shop, inside a bar, morning, afternoon, night. If I was where she was, I stared at her. I wanted to talk to her, but I didn't. Never hello, never how are you, never what's up, never what's new. I never said a word. I just stared at her. After a while, I knew that she knew I was doing it, but she never told me to stop. I just stared. She disappeared at the beginning of our third year. I didn't know where she went, and I didn't ask anyone. It wasn't uncommon for students to spend time away, either abroad or working, so I assumed she would be back. If she hadn't come back, I would have left to find her. She was away, away. And if she hadn't come back, I would have searched to the end of the earth. I would have searched until I found her. I saw her again in a class. It was the first class of a new fall, 15 months from the time of her disappearance. I walked in drunk from the night before and dizzy with dehydration and exhaustion, and I took a seat in the back of the room, away from the rest of the students, as far away as I could get. I put my arms down on my desk, and I put my head down in my arms, and I closed my eyes, and my head spun, my stomach spun, my body spun, and I tried to keep myself awake, and I tried to keep myself from getting sick. I didn't want to get sick on the first day of class. I raised my head when I heard the professor say hello and welcome to a new year, and she was there, in the front row, with Lucinda. And another girl whom I had seen before, but whom I didn't know. She was there. I hadn't seen her in over a year. I would have searched to the end of the earth. She was there. I sat and stared at her. I forgot that I was drunk. forgot that I was sick, forgot that I was in class, forgot that I was in school, forgot that I had friends, family, a life, a name, a face, a mind. I forgot everything, forgot everything, and I stared at her. Though I was behind her, I could see that she had changed since I last saw her. She had gained weight, grown her hair longer, gotten a tan, and she radiated a quiet, calm confidence that hadn't been there before. She was wearing black, and the black made her hair more blonde, and though I couldn't see, I knew it made her eyes more blue. I would have gone to the ends of the earth. When class ended, I didn't want it to end. I just wanted to stare. She stood up, and she turned around, as if she knew I was there. Two eyes locked and loaded behind her, and she stared back at me. And I held her stare, arctic blue against pale green. She stared, and I held it until the class was empty, and she turned around, and she walked out. I took a deep breath, and I followed her. She walked through the halls of the building. It was the humanities building, and it was crowded with the excitement and the noise of a new year. She walked quickly, but held at corners and in stairways, long enough to let me see her way, and long enough to let me know she wanted me to see her way. Arctic blue against pale green. We had held. I lost her somewhere near the main entrance to the building, and I panicked. I didn't want to lose her, and I hurried outside, immediately scanning, looking. Where did she go? I want to see her stare at her. Where did she go? Arctic blue. Where? And I heard a voice say my name. Say it clear, pure, in a strong, simple way, like sunlight on a rock in shallow water. Clear, pure, simple, and strong, a voice said my name. James. I stopped and I turned around, and she was standing on a large, wide, stone stair, the first in a set of 10. She was standing there, waiting for me. James.
What?
Why do you stare at me?
What?
You stare at me. I want to know why.
You already know why.
I don't.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
You do. You just want to hear me say it.
Tell me why you stare.
I took a deep breath. The first time I saw you, my heart fell. The second time I saw you, my heart fell. The third time, fourth time, fifth time, and every time since, my heart has fallen.
I stared at her.
You are the most beautiful woman I have ever seen. Your hair, your eyes, your lips, your body that you haven't grown into, the way you walk, smile, laugh, the way your cheeks drop when you're mad or upset, the way you drag your feet when you're tired. Every single thing about you is beautiful.
I stared at her.
When I see you, the world stops. It stops, and all that exists for me is you and my eyes staring at you. There's nothing else. No noise, no other people, no thoughts or worries, no yesterday, no tomorrow. The world just stops. And it is a beautiful place, and there is only you. Just you and my eyes staring at you.
I stared.
When you're gone, the world starts again, and I don't like it as much. I can live in it, but I don't like it. I just walk around in it and wait to see you again and wait for it to stop again. I love it when it stops. It's the best fucking thing I've ever known or ever felt. The best thing. And that, beautiful girl, is why I stare at you.
We were standing a foot apart, staring at each other, arctic and pale, locked and loaded. The world had stopped and there was nothing else. Just me and her, arctic and pale, locked and loaded. She smiled.
That was beautiful.
It was true.
Thank you.
No problem.
What are you doing now?
I've got another class. Then I'm going to go get drunk.
Seriously?
Yeah.
The stories are true?
I don't know what you've heard, but probably.
I was hoping they weren't.
Don't know what to tell you. I took a step backward, down another stair. I'll see you around?
She smiled and she nodded. Yes.
I turned and I walked away, and my legs were shaking like jelly with each step down the stairs. I knew she was watching me walk away, and waiting for me to turn back for another smile, and I would have liked another smile. I would have liked the world to stop, and she was waiting for it, but I didn't turn around. I kept going, an image in my mind, arctic and pale, locked and loaded, beautiful, magnificent, mysterious, and wonderful. It was in my mind. I knew it wasn't going anywhere. I listened to the tick of an unseen clock marking moments of time long past. It takes me, the tick, and it holds me, and it carries and keeps me like the slow swing of a pendulum before the eyes of an idiot. The world has stopped, not like before, and not in a good way. It has stopped and is not going forward the same way my life has stopped and is not going forward. It is not going forward, or backward, or anywhere at all. It has just stopped. It has just stopped. The clock holds me nowhere, nowhere, nowhere. There is nothing else but now and the shifting depth of night. I sit at a table alone, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and listening and surviving. I should not be here or anywhere. I should not be breathing or taking space. I should not have been given this moment or anything else. I should not have this opportunity again to live. I do not deserve it or deserve anything, yet it is here, and I am here, and I have it all of it still. I won't have it again. This moment or this chance, they are the same thing. This moment and this chance, they are the same, and they are mine if I choose them, and I do. I want them. Now and as long as I can have them, they are both precious and fleeting, and gone in the blink of an eye. Don't waste them. A moment and an opportunity and a life, all in the unseen tick of a clock holding me nowhere. My heart is beating. The walls are pale and quiet. I am surviving. The dark shifts away from itself, and light invades it and conquers. The unit is empty still, but for me. I stand, and I want to breathe deeply and breathe without boundary. And I walk to the door, and I open it, and I go outside. I walk toward the lake, which is covered with a frigid mist born from the difference between inside and out. The mist hovers above the clear, calm black of the water, moving up, but not moving at all. Changing shape, but staying the same. I like the mist, and I want to take it in and let it become me. I want to drink it and be full. I want to swallow it and let it make me. Make me how I should be made, mist. Make me what I should be made. I sit on the middle bench. It is cold on my legs and back, but the cold is a counterpoint to the coffee and the cigarettes and the night. I look out unmoving and strong until a bird sweeps down and sweeps through, carving its way like northern ice drifting south. It moves up and out and above the mist, and it finds a tree, and it sits on the tree and it rests, looking back, not at me, but at that which it sought. It is not there now or again, so it stays. The bird stays on the branch of the tree, stiff and true, looking, seeking, searching, waiting. It stays stiff and true. There is a noise behind me, and I turn to the noise. There is a figure emerging from the reflection of the glass door. The figure is bundled beneath layers of cotton and bright blue nylon. It wears glasses and a hat. It shuts the door, and it sees me, and it comes toward me one step at a time, purposefully through the thick, shimmering dew. I do not want it, the figure, and whatever it may bring, so I turn away from it, and I look out across the water, unmoving and strong. The bird is still there, looking, seeking, searching, waiting, sitting stiff and true. The steps are closer, and I can see the cotton and the nylon out of the corner of my eye. I try to ignore it, but there's a voice. "Hey, kid!" I know the voice. Hey, Leonard.
He stands in front of me.
Mind if I sit?
I stare at the mist.
They're not my benches.
He laughs and he sits.
Why are you up so early?
I stare at the mist.
Couldn't sleep.
Roy?
Among other things.
What are the other things?
Nothing I'm gonna talk about.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Leonard stands.
Let's go for a walk.
I stay on the bench.
No, thanks.
Come on.
No.
Why?
I look up.
I don't know if I can be seen with you in that sweatsuit.
He looks at himself and back at me.
What's wrong with the sweatsuit?
What's it made of?
He rubs it, smiles.
It's a rayon nylon satin blend.
I laugh.
That's the first thing that's wrong with it.
What's the second?
You got your gold watch on.
I love this watch.
And your silly glasses.
They're Gucci.
I don't care what they are, they're silly.
He takes them off, looks at them, puts them in his pocket.
How's that?
It's better.
He smiles, motions toward the wood.
Let's go for a walk, kid.
I stand and we start walking and we find a trail through the wood.
Leonard asks how I'm doing and I tell him I'm fine.
He asks me again and I tell him I'm fine again.
He asks me again, and I tell him I'm fucking fine,
and he tells me that fine isn't a good enough answer. He wants to know how I'm really doing.
I tell him I don't know.
He asks me what that means, and I tell him I don't know how I'm doing, that sometimes I feel good, and sometimes I feel something far less, far, far less than good.
He says that if that's what I'm feeling, then I'm doing well. And I should just keep doing, and I'll get better, and my life will get better. Everything will get better, and I laugh at him.
He asks me why I'm laughing, and I tell him I'm laughing because I don't think that he, as a coke addict and a fellow patient and a fuck-up of the first order, is in any position to give me advice.
He laughs, and he says, "Let's find a place to sit down, kid. I got a story to tell you."
We walk until we find a bench along one of the smaller lakes. It is a plain wooden bench that looks as if it has been carved from a single chunk of wood. Its edges are rough, its surface is uneven, and like all of the benches at this time of day, it is cold. The sun has started rising, and shafts of yellow and white are burning away in mist. Floating sheets of gray ice are shifting and cracking, the crack like a gunshot, and icicles hanging from extended branches of oak and pine are dripping, the drip melting the cover of frost beneath. Though I am lightly dressed, I am warm. My heart is beating and I am surviving, and I am warm.
Leonard looks out across the lake. He is calmer than I have ever seen him. The edge of violence, control, and power that he carries is gone. His hands are still on his lap. His breathing is deep and slow, and his eyes are focused on something in the distance, though they aren't really looking at it. His eyes are looking inside, reviewing, remembering, figuring out how to tell. Without moving, he starts to speak.
I told you how my father died, how he got hit by a truck and killed. Before he died, as he lay in a hospital bed, he took my hand, and he told me that the only thing he ever wanted from me was that one day I'd be successful enough to play the golf course he mowed for 15 years, just like I was one of the members. I promised him that someday I'd do it.
Leonard takes a deep breath.
I told you how my mother died and how Michelangelo and Gina adopted me and raised me like I was their own. On top of raising me, Michelangelo guided me into his business. What that isn't important for you to know. What's important is that he taught me to do it and he set me up in it. I took care of details for him and he watched over and protected me. An opportunity came up for Michelangelo and Gina to move to Las Vegas. They took it, and I went with them. We did very well, very quickly. As Vegas was growing and booming, so were we. We had money, houses, cars, whatever we wanted. It was all there, everything we ever wanted.
Leonard stops talking, stares at the ground. He takes a deep breath, looks up. Then Gina got cancer. It was a bad cancer, cancer of the bones, and it took her quickly and brutally. In 3 fucking months, and she went from being the most beautiful woman in the world to a fucking skeleton. And when it killed her, in a certain way, it killed both me and Michelangelo, too. He shakes his head, stares across the lake. Nothing was ever the same. Michelangelo lost interest in our business and turned it over to me. I didn't see him much after that. I think we just reminded each other of what we had lost. Those were shitty, depressing years. We both started drinking more and doing too much cocaine, but Michelangelo completely lost it. A day came when I needed to see him, talk to him about something, so I went over to his house. I hadn't been there in months, and when I walked in, I was sick to my stomach. There were mirrors full of coke on tables, bottles and cans everywhere, garbage piles in every room, and blonde girls with big fake tits sleeping on the couches and lounging by the pool. I went up to his room, and he was sitting there with a couple of young girls and a bunch of drugs. I told the girls to get out, and I walked them out to the pool. I sat him down and looked him in the eye, and I said, "Mikey, you should be fucking ashamed of yourself. You should be ashamed of how you're living, and ashamed that you're desecrating the memory of your wife. Gina would have wanted better for you, and if she's up in heaven watching you, she's probably crying her eyes out." He didn't say a word to me. He just turned around and walked out of the house. I didn't know where he went, didn't hear from him at all, so I started mourning him. My mourning was just like his. I drank too much, did too much coke, and did a lot of stupid bullshit. About a year later, I'm asleep in my bed, and I hear someone in my house. I always keep a gun under my pillow, so I reached for it and started walking around. I heard someone in my kitchen, and I walked in, and there was Michelangelo, 50 pounds lighter, looking better and healthier than I'd ever seen him. He looked at me, and he asked why the fridge was so goddamn empty. I gave him a hug, and I asked him where he'd been. And he told me he was here, at this clinic, where you and I are right now. He told me that when he had left his house the day I sat him down, he had planned on driving into the desert and blowing his brains out. But once he got there, he couldn't do it. He decided that if he was going to die, he wanted to die how he'd lived most of his life, which was with dignity and honor. He had heard about this place and decided he was going to come here. He bought a map and drove up here from Vegas and stayed until he felt he was better. Then he got in his car and he drove around for a few months, saw the White House and Key West and Bourbon Street and Alaska. He saw everything he had always wanted to see but never had. He had come home to tell me that he was going to retire and that he wanted me to come here. He said this place changed his life. He said getting sober had been the hardest thing he'd ever done, but next to getting married and spending his life with Gina, it was the best thing he'd ever done. He wanted me to do it. He said he wouldn't ever leave or die until I did. We spent the rest of the day playing golf and talking about this place. He said when he first got here, he thought he had made a big mistake. He thought about leaving, but didn't. A few days later, he felt better, and he knew something was working. A month after that, he knew he was going to be okay. There were still bad times and rough times, and times when he didn't think he was going to make it, but when they came, he just held on. He held on tight and with everything he had until the good started coming back. When he was finally ready to go, he said he knew he wasn't ever going to drink or use again. He said he walked out of here happy and proud. For the next few days, we talked more about the effect that this place had on him. And we talked more about me coming here. About a week after that, he came by my house and picked me up and told me he was taking me out to eat at my favorite restaurant. I don't know how he did it without me knowing, but he had set up a big dinner with all of our friends, even some of our old ones from New York. When we walked in, they were all waiting for us. We ate, drank, snorted coke. Michelangelo told me that he was putting me on a plane the next day. So I really went at it. After a couple hours, he told me he was going home. He said he didn't feel entirely right spending an entire evening with so much liquor and so many drugs. He gave me a hug and said he'd pick me up at noon to take me to the airport. I hugged him back and told him I'd be ready, and I was going to make him proud. He said he already knew. Leonard takes a deep breath. He turned, and he walked away, headed toward the valet. I watched him from the door as he waited for his car, hoping that he'd turn around so that I could wave to him. As he was standing there, a black Lincoln pulled up and the windows went down. I knew what was happening, and I tried to yell, but before I could say anything, the barrels came out. They started blazing away, just blazing the fuck away. Michelangelo went down straight away, and even as he was down, the guns kept fucking blazing. By the time I got there, he was done. Hit 16 times. Twice in the chest, 4 in the stomach, the rest in his arms and legs. People were running all over the place. There was blood everywhere, and he was done. Shot 16 times by a carload of cowardly fucks. Leonard's voice cracks and tears start running down his cheeks. I held him as he bled. Just held him and told him how much I loved him. He was still conscious and he could still talk, but he knew he was done. Right before he went, he lifted a bloody hand and he put it on my cheek. He looked me in the eye and he said, "Live honorably and with dignity. Respect the memories of all your parents. I want you to play the course of your first father and play it like one of the members, and I want you to live sober and live free. Do that for me, Leonard. Live sober and live free. It's gonna be hard and scary and brutal, but if you just hold on, you'll be okay. Just hold on." And then he died, right in my arms, shot down like a fucking dog. He died in my arms. Leonard breaks down and starts weeping. It is a strong, shaking, sobbing, racking weeping, the weeping that comes from a wound that will never heal. I let him weep, leave him be with his memories and his loss and his pain. I would offer him comfort, but it wouldn't matter. The wounds that never heal can only be mourned alone. He regains his composure, and with it his edge of violence, control, and power. He stares out across the lake at the burning mist and the floating, cracking ice, but with an image of the dead held firm in his mind. I didn't get on my plane the next day, or any day, for a long time. I buried Michelangelo next to Gina, and I wept at their graves just like I wept a moment ago, and just like I weep whenever I think of them. Then I spent a week locked in my house, getting blitzed beyond comprehension. When I emerged after that week, the only thing on my mind was vengeance. I spent the next year tracking down the motherfuckers responsible for Michelangelo's murder. Then I found the motherfuckers they worked for, and then I found the motherfuckers those motherfuckers worked for. What I did to them does not deserve to be spoken of, but I will tell you that I did not give them the luxury of being held by someone who loved them when I turned their fucking lights out. I spent the year after that drinking and doing blow and trying to get my ass on that goddamn golf course in Westchester. I wasn't able to, so I decided to take a break and come here. The thought being that if I wasn't able to make my first father proud, I would damn well do it for the second. It has been incredibly hard being here and doing this, much harder than I imagined it would be. When I got here, I was a fucking wreck. Not a wreck like you were, but bad enough. Every second that passed was a miserable hell. Now, it's getting easier, but it's still fucking awful. And there are still a lot more bad times than good times, and a lot more bad feelings than good feelings. I don't know what I think about higher powers and 12 steps and all the rest of what they talk about in here, but I do know that when things are tough, and when I don't think I can last another minute, if I just hold on tight, and with everything I got, the shit gets better. The old man was right, just like he was always right, and he spoke the truth with his final words. Just hold on. Just hold on. Leonard turns and he stares at me. I stare back. I told you this story for a number of reasons. The most important is that when you get down, or you don't think you can fucking do this anymore, just hold on. And sooner or later, the shit is gonna get better. We stare at each other. As I said before, kid, you walk out of here, and I'm having you brought back. As many times as it takes, I will have you brought the fuck back. You can go ahead and test me on that if you want, but I would suggest you not. The smart thing would be to take my advice. I may be a coke addict and a fellow patient and a fuck-up of the first order, but I am giving you good advice. Be smart. Be strong. Be proud. Live honorably and with dignity, and just hold on. We stare at each other. I am listening to him, and respecting the words that he is speaking. They are true. They come from a place of experience and feeling. I can believe in those things. Truth, experience, and feeling. I can believe in them. Just hold on. You think you can do that? I nod. Yeah, I can do that. He smiles. You're not going to fight me on this. I shake my head. No, I'm not going to fight you. You're getting better, kid. I chuckle. I turn and I look back across the lake. The mist is gone and the ice diminished. The drip of the icicles quick and heavy. The sun is up and the sky is blue, empty blue, light blue, clear blue. I would drink the sky if I could drink it. Drink it and celebrate it, and let it fill me and become me. I am getting better. Empty and clear and light and blue. I am getting better. Leonard speaks. It's about time for breakfast. Yeah. Leonard stands. I look up at him. Thank you, Leonard. He smiles. Sure, kid. I stand. I think about saying something else, but I don't know any words to express the strong, simple, and deep appreciation I feel. I reach up and out, and I put my arms around Leonard and I hug him. I don't know any words, so I let my actions speak. Strong, simple, and deep appreciation. The actions speak true. We separate, and we start walking back to the clinic. As we move along the trail, we pass other patients, and we say hello to them, or nod to them, or exchange brief pleasantries with them. Most of them seem to be walking for exercise, and most of them seem to know where they're going. A few are just walking to walk. A few look lost. We get to the dining hall, and we get trays, and we get food, and we sit down at a table with Maddie and Ed and Ted and Miles and a man named Bobby. Bobby, who is short and fat and has the pink skin and red hair of an Irishman, has a huge plate of food in front of him. In between giant mouthfuls of runny eggs, he is telling stories. Maddie and Ed and Ted are egging him on. Miles is sitting and quietly listening. He doesn't acknowledge us as we join them. He doesn't stop eating or talking. The fat jowl beneath his chin doesn't stop jiggling. He is telling a story about some mobsters he knows in Brooklyn, claiming that he manages their money through investments in the stock market, and they get him drugs and women and whatever else he wants. When he talks of amounts of drugs, Maddie laughs and says he should have asked for more. Bobby then corrects himself and says that he actually did get more. When he talks of women, Ed tells him that four at a time isn't that big a deal, and Bobby says the next time he had eight. He mentions crack and the amounts of it he claims to smoke, and Ted asks him what it feels like, that he has always wanted to try it. Bobby says that it feels like really strong weed. In reality, it does not at all. Ted laughs at him, feigning awe and amazement. Leonard sits carefully and quietly watching and listening. Occasionally, Leonard asks Bobby questions about who he claims to know and how he claims to know them. I can't tell if Leonard knows all the people he and Bobby are talking about, but I can tell that Leonard is sizing him up. I don't think he's all that impressed. Eventually, I get tired of Bobby and his bullshit, and I snicker at a comment he makes about the amount of money he earns. which he claims to be in the millions each year. He stops talking, and he stares at me, and he asks me what the fuck I think is so funny. I stare back, and I tell him that I find his lies amusing. And Miles speaks for the first time since the breakfast began, and he says they certainly are. Bobby, like all liars confronted, is instantly defensive and instantly mad. He asks who the fuck I am and where the fuck do I get off accusing him. I tell him I'm no one, and I get off because I have decided that I do. He tells me that he's not the kind of man to let his honor be disrespected in that way, and that I best retract my statement or face the consequences of it, and the image of him trying to do something to me, all 300 fat-ass pounds of him jiggling toward me in a fit of primal rage, is humorous. I laugh at him, and he stands, and he asks me if I want to go, "Come on, you little punk, let's go right now." And I stand and I say, "Sure, let's go right now." He looks toward Lincoln and Keith, who are eating a few tables away, and he says, "You're lucky they're here or I'd kick your ass." I laugh at him, and I pick up my tray, and I walk away. I put my tray on the conveyor. As I turn around, I bump into Lily. She drops her tray, and it hits the floor, and there's a mess, and she bends over to clean it up, and I bend over to help her. As I reach for an empty coffee cup, she slides her hand across my hand, and I can feel a piece of folded paper within her hand. As she slides it away, the piece of paper stays, just like a drug deal on a street corner. Two hands exchanging a small folded piece of paper in what looks like a harmless gesture. Her hand hitting my hand. The piece of paper stays. We pick up a plate and an empty cereal bowl and a fork and a knife and a spoon. We put them on her tray, and she puts her tray on the conveyor, and I walk away, just like on the street corner. I want whatever is in or on the piece of paper, and I want it immediately, just like on the street corner. I know I have to wait till I'm alone. Just like on the street corner, I know I shouldn't have it. I put the piece of paper in the front pocket of my pants, and I go to the lecture hall, and I find a seat in the back row. I am early, and the hall is nearly empty. I reach into my pockets, and I pull out the piece of paper. Just like on the street corner, my hands are shaking, and my heart is pounding. My eyes won't focus. I have to concentrate to make them focus. If I don't get whatever is in there and get it fast, I'm going to go fucking crazy. My hands are shaking. I unfold it. There is nothing inside, though I'm not sure if I was expecting something inside. If there had been drugs, I don't know what I would have done with them. Part of me would have taken them immediately. And with great need, part of me would have run to the nearest toilet to get rid of them. I don't know what I would have done. I turn the paper over, and there are words. I can see words. I need to concentrate, focus, be calm enough to read the words. I can read them. They say, "Meet me in our clearing at 4. I read them again. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. I read them over and over, and they say the same thing over and over. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. My hands are shaking, shaking, and my heart is beating, beating, and my eyes won't focus. I have to concentrate to make them focus. "Meet me in our clearing at 4. Again and again, again and again. Patients start trickling into the lecture hall. I carefully fold the piece of paper and return it to its place in my pocket. I sit staring straight ahead, thinking about 4 o'clock, until I am joined by Leonard and Ed and Ted and Maddie and Miles. They are laughing and in jovial moods, talking about Bobby and reliving the games they played with him. They tell me that after I left, Ted told him that I was a yoga instructor from San Francisco with an addiction to a rare Indian drug called shampoo, pronounced just like the hair product, but spelled C-H-A-M-P-U-U. Bobby's reaction was to say that he's beaten down a yoga instructor before, and that he wouldn't hesitate to do it again. The lecture starts, and it is about the 5th step of the Almighty 12. It is being given by a Catholic priest. I don't listen to a word of it. I sit and I stare across the lecture hall. I sit and I stare at Lily. The lecture ends. I stand and I follow the rest of the patients out, enveloped in the flood toward the doors, enveloped in the flood of my memories. As I step out and into the hall, Ken is standing waiting for me. Waiting as he always waits. It seems as if he's always standing there waiting for me. James?
What's up, Ken?
Checking to see if you've completed the first step workbook.
I have not.
Have you looked at it?
Not since you gave it to me.
I'd like you to spend the morning working on it.
Okay.
Take your time, but if you finish, bring it by my office. If I'm not there, just leave it on my desk.
Will do.
Any progress on the goal board?
No.
Put a little thought into that as well.
Okay.
I'll see you later. Looking forward to it.
Ken chuckles and he walks away. I turn in the opposite direction, and I walk to the unit. I go to the lower level, and I get a box of Crayolas, and I check for Razzle Dazzle Rose. It's there, as are 63 other beautiful crayons. As I start back up the stairs, I see the goal board hanging on a wall in the upper level. I walk over to it, and I stand in front of it, and I stare at it. It is a large piece of laminated poster board divided into boxes using vertical and horizontal lines. In each of the boxes is a name, written in erasable marker, and next to the name is a goal. Some of the goals are simple, things such as find a job and keep it, stay sober for 60 days, be a functioning part of society. Some of the goals are sad, things like get my wife to talk to me, regain the respect of my children, stay out of jail for 6 months. Most of the goals are things like improve my relationship with my friend and savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. Work the program right and live the steps in every moment. Get myself in shape. Be buff in mind, be buff in spirit, be buff in body. The goal next to Maddie's name reads, stop fucking swearing, which makes me laugh. The goal next to Leonard's name reads, hold on, which makes me smile. The goal next to Miles's name reads, live, which makes the most sense. The space next to my name remains empty. In the face of surviving long enough to survive in the long term, there is no goal that comes to mind that means anything to me. I could write survive, but I would rather hold that word in my heart than write it on some fucking board. When I was laughing earlier, laughing about being a yoga instructor and being addicted to shampoo, the laughing felt good. When I have laughed at all here, which has been too infrequent an occasion, it has always felt good. I could write laugh on the board, but I would rather write something that makes me laugh every time I see it. So I pick up a marker, and next to my name I write, I'm going to L.A. to make all of my dreams come true. I'm going to be a Laker girl. When I am finished, I laugh. When I step back and I read my words again, I laugh. As I walk from the upper level and I enter the hall which leads to my room, I laugh. Laughing feels good. I haven't laughed enough and I want to laugh more. I'm going to L.A. to become a motherfucking Laker girl. I walk into my room and I sit down on my bed and I open the box of Crayolas and I open the workbook and I pull the Razzle Dazzle Rose from the box and I start reading. The first part of the book tells the story of Joe. Joe is a drunk who loses his wife, his job, all of his money, and ends up in the street drinking cheap wine straight from the bottle. All the while, Joe refuses to admit that he has a problem or that he has lost control. The story is told in simple words and in simple pictures consisting of empty outlines of figures and places, the inside of the outlines being the part that needs coloring. The idea, I am guessing, is that while spending time filling in the pictures, I am supposed to grasp the horror of Joe's story, and then relate that horror to situations in my own life. If Joe is out of control, I must be out of control as well. If Joe ended up on the street, I better be careful, or I will end up in the street with him. In the back of the book, after the conclusion of Joe's story, which has a happy ending when he admits that he has lost all control and he joins AA, is a 27-question survey about the pattern of an individual's drinking. The questions are simple, and all of them require yes or no answers. Did you ever wake up on the morning after drinking and discover that you could not remember part of the evening before? Yes. Are there certain situations when you feel uncomfortable if alcohol is unavailable? Yes. When you are sober, do you regret things you have done while you were drinking? Yes. Do you have the shakes in the morning after drinking? Yes. Do you sometimes stay drunk for several days at a time? Yes, 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 yes. I answer yes to every question, all 27 of them, which, according to the key at the end of the survey, means that I'm in the late stages of chronic and dangerous alcoholism. Tell me something I don't fucking know. I put the razzle-dazzle rose crayon back in the box, and I pull out the black crayon. Unlike most of the other crayons, black has hardly been used. People probably avoid black because it isn't considered a happy color, and in here, any form of happiness, even something as base as the color of a crayon, is coveted. I, however, like black. It is a color that makes me comfortable, and the color with which I have the most experience. In the darkest darkness, all is black. In the deepest hole, all is black. In the terror of my addicted mind, all is black. In the empty periods of my lost memory, all is black. I like black, goddammit, and I am going to give it its due. I flip back the pages of the book until I reach the first page. I pick up the beautiful black crayon, and I write I in a large, simple block style, starting at the top of the page and finishing at the bottom, crossing over and ignoring any and all of the outlined figures. On the next page, I write don't. On each of the following pages, I write need this bullshit to know I'm out of control. When I am finished, I review my work. Each page looks perfect, and I like it. I close the book. Job well done, James. I don't need this bullshit to know I'm out of control. Job well done. I have an hour before lunch, so I toss the coloring book on the floor where it belongs, and I pick up the Tao Te Ching. I look at it, front and back, at the stupid quotes and the silly lettering and the funny name. I wonder if I was suffering from an episode of insanity when I last read it. I wonder if I was just tired or vulnerable from my encounter in the clearing with Lily. I wonder if the sound of Miles's clarinet had somehow hypnotized me. I look at the book, and I wonder how it affected me the way it did. I read only 4 pages. I open it at number 5 on page 5. I let my eyes run across the words. I let my brain process them. I let my heart feel them. Number 5 is like the rest. There is no good or evil, no sinner or saint. There simply is what is, and that is it. You can use that to be, and that is enough. Don't talk about it or question it. Just let it be. Just be. It still affects me, and it still makes sense. It still moves me, and it still rings true. That is all that matters. The truth. Does it ring true? It does. I can feel it. Number 6. The Tao is the great mother, the great father, the great nothing. It is empty and inexhaustible. It is always present. You can use it or not. Does it ring true? It does. 7. Infinite and eternal. It was never born and will never die. It is just there. It wants nothing and it needs nothing. It is just there. Stay behind and get ahead. Detach and become. Let go of all and you will be full. Let go of all and you will be full. 8 and 9 say the good is like water that nourishes without trying. They say in thinking, keep to simple. In conflict, be fair. They say don't compare or compete, simply be yourself. They say fill your bowl to the brim and it will spill. Keep sharpening your knife and it will dull. They say chase after money and your heart will never unclench. Care about what other people think and you will always be their prisoner. These things, these poems, these words, these meanings, they make sense to me. They do not tell me to do anything or be anything or believe in anything or become anything. They don't judge me or try to convince me. There is no righteousness or pretension. They don't fight me or insult me or tell me I'm wrong. There is no authority, and there are no rules. They're just words strung together on a page, sitting and waiting patiently for me to accept or reject them. They don't care if I do either or both or nothing at all. They will never tell me I'm wrong. They will never tell me I'm right, either. They just sit there. I don't read them again. I close the book, and I let them sit. I am on my bed, and I like my bed. It is soft and warm, and I am not soft or warm, but I imagine that it would be nice to be that way. I have never known it. I know a cold, hard, raging fury deep inside of me, and I am tired of it. I am tired of the feeling. I want to die so that I don't have to feel it anymore. I would like to be soft and warm. I would be terrified to be that way. I could be hurt if I were soft and warm. I could be hurt by something other than myself. It is harder to be soft than it is to be hard. I could be hurt by something other than myself. It is nearing noon. I can hear men talking outside my room. They are walking to the dining hall. They are laughing about something. I wonder what they'll feel when the laughing stops. In here, laughing is the only drug. Laughing or love. They are both drugs. I get out of bed and I take my coloring book to Ken's office. It's empty, so I leave the book on his desk. I go to the dining hall, and I get a plate of macaroni and beef, and I sit down with the same men I eat with at every meal. Maddie, Ed, Ted, Leonard, Miles. It's a typical meal. Stories and swearing, and a few laughs. As we're finishing, Lincoln walks over and tells us we don't have to go to the lecture, that we're having a unit meeting instead. Ed asks him why, and he says, "Don't worry about it. Just show up." I finish eating, and I put my tray on the conveyor. I walk back to the unit, and I join the rest of the men on the lower level. They are sitting on the couches, smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee. The topic of conversation is Roy. The latest theory making rounds is that he was drunk. Alcohol can do powerful things to a person. But as the various drug theorists point out, Roy did not have the slurred speech and dulled reactions that are indicative of a serious drinking binge. They say it had to be drugs, though they argue among themselves as to what type. Bobby, who wasn't here when the incident took place, tries to end the argument with a proclamation that Roy must have been using a powerful type of diet pills, that he's seen it happen a dozen times before on Wall Street. Maddie tells him he's fucking crazy. Goddamn diet pills can't fucking do that to a motherfucking person. Bobby asks Maddie if he knows what Wall Street is and where it's located. Maddie tells Bobby it ain't gonna fucking matter where the fuck Wall Street is when I drop your fat fucking ass with a nice right hand. Bobby laughs and says, "Go ahead, little man. It will be the last mistake you ever make." Maddie stands up and takes a step forward, but Leonard tells him to sit down, that Bobby isn't worth the trouble. Maddie sits down. Lincoln walks in and he pulls up a chair and he sits at the head of the group. Everyone quiets down and waits for him to start talking. He sits down and he stares at the floor for a moment and he looks up. He speaks. "Most of you know Roy and witnessed his behavior last night.